Flex and Mazinga, the museum's head of humanities, took me round.
Now, this map here shows the different routes that David Livingstone took. He stayed in Southern Africa, Kromane, for 10 years. But because of the problems he encountered there in terms of converting the Africans there, he decided to move further north because he had head of another big empire here. That's when he came into contact with this big river, the Zambezi River. And at that time, his intention was to open Central Africa to more missionaries to come in, because he realized that he himself alone could not cope with all the work. Now, here we have his impressions of the Victoria Falls. He took measurements, the width, the depth, and so on, and then drew them in a notebook like that one. This is just a photocopy. We have the original.
That is really quite amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
yes,
it's just a tattered piece of paper,
yes,
with a sort of wiggly line on it.
Yes.
But then sketched on it are all these calculations,
yes,
about,
yes,
the height of it,
yes,
the fall of it, and, yes, so on. I remember that many Zambians,
yes,
got very, very upset,
okay,
when they heard Europeans say that David Livingstone discovered the Victoria Falls.
Yes, I'm one of those actually.
Now tell us why you get upset.
Because implication of the word discover is he is the first person to see it, which is wrong. We have all the evidence that now he was in the company of Sekereto, and 200 other potters escorted him up to the falls. Okay, those two are the famous helpers to Livingstone, Chuma and Susi.
Ah. Now, when he died at,
yes,
Chitambo,
yes,
which is up the Great North Road,
yes, in Serenja,
these were the two followers, were they not, who cut his heart out?
Yes.
Buried it,
yes,
at the foot of the tree where he died.
Yes, Mpundu tree, yes.
And then carried his body.
Yes.
How many miles?
Now, from Serenja to Dasaram, I don't know, it's thousands and thousands of miles. And because of the distance involved, they had to take precautions. When they opened him up, they let the body dry for 15 days. And then got the bark of a tree. Okay, first wrapped it in a cloth, and then put it in this bag, and carried the whole body. This map that you see here depicts the different missionary groups that came to Zambia. As you can see, the whole country was really covered. By 1920, all those stations had been established.
It looks as though they sort of divided the whole country up between them.
Yes.
Now, did they do that by general agreement?
Not necessarily. Sometimes they would make consultations before coming in, so they would know which area they would want to settle. Perhaps the only area which is recorded to have had some conflicts over who should settle in one area was Southern Province. We had the Seventh Adventists and the Jesuit Fathers. So that clash was going on for... In fact, up to now, the two churches don't seem to be friendly.
The church to which I belong, the Methodist Church, also chose to work in the southern province of northern Rhodesia. But when the copper mines were opened on what became known as the Copper Belt, the Methodists joined an interdenominational team of missionaries working in the mining towns. In 1956, when I arrived to become minister in Chingola, home of the huge Inchanga mine, there was still a rigid colour bar throughout the territory. 37 years later, on one of those glorious sunny African mornings, I went back to my old church. The moderator of the Copper Belt Presbytery introduced me to a congregation, many of whom weren't even born when I was last in the church.
Reverend Colin Morris is a man who played a great role in the political life of this country also. He saw it to independence. And in 1965, when we came into union, he was elected as the first president of the United States of Zambia. So he has come to visit and see what he left, whether it is going in peace or in pieces. This place is full of ghosts for me. Many ghosts in this place.
When I arrived here, the people told me all the stories of what had happened to the church. And when Colin would have preached one of his sermons, you know, backing independence, then he would stand at the church door and various members would come out, shake him by the hand and say, "Thank you very much, Mr. Morris. That is the last time you will ever see me in your church. Goodbye. I don't agree with your ideas." And actually the church was emptied from being a church which was very full of members, because obviously with Colin's oratory, people went along to hear him preach. But when he started, as it were, on the political line and backing independence, the church was virtually emptied, bar for a few people who did back him and stood up for him.
Yes, the Jackie Kyle, one of the immortals of Irish international rugby. He's still the surgeon at the local hospital.
When I was church secretary, at the time, Colin Morris arrived in Chingola, and my late husband, Howarth Senegals, was in charge of the building of the new church. I can remember that the situation on the Copper Belt became much worse. So Colin Morris preached an outspoken sermon on the role of the church in politics, and his text was from Isaiah 58, and that service had received wide newspaper coverage. And the service, to all intents and purposes, had gone down very well. But a few days after, we turned up for a meeting at church and discovered, to our disbelief, that the whole of the church had been desecrated and was in an indescribable mess. I can remember the communion table had been overturned and damaged, the beautiful copper cross had been thrown into whitewash, and Christmas spray had been used to scrawl obscenities and graffiti on the windows and walls. But worst of all, the large, beautifully tooled leather pulpit Bible, which had been a gift from the African churches, had been removed, and the text which Colin Morris had used for the political sermon had been slashed right across.